Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht, and I'm an interviewer with the New Books Network. And today on the Russian and Eurasian Studies podcast, we're going to be talking to Professor Roger Reese, who's written a new book called The Imperial Russian Army in Peace, War, and Revolution. So thank you for being with us here, Roger.
My pleasure.
All right. Starting off, I was wondering if you could tell the listeners a bit about yourself, how you got into Russian history, where you studied, what you started off writing about, how you got interested in military history specifically, and so on.
Okay. Well, I could start earliest as I got interested in military history pretty young, just reading in my spare time, and even as early as like fifth grade, somehow I gravitated to it. My father was in the Army, so I lived on a lot of different military bases growing up, for a few years at least. And so that was the origins of it. And then I ended up going to university at Texas A&M University with the intent of becoming a commissioned officer. And I majored in history, obviously, because that's it appeals to me tremendously, but also it had the least mathematics requirements, and that was even more appealing. So studied. We didn't actually have a military history major, but I concentrated my history classes in European history, and the few military history classes that we had, and that's how I got interested in the Russian military. I had a very encouraging professor, Chester Dunning. He's just retired, actually, a few years ago. Took a couple classes with him on Imperial Russian history and on Soviet history, and I just found it immensely intriguing. So from there, I just kind of filed that away and went off to the Army and did 3 years in the Army and decided that that was enough. I had a good time, made a lot of good friends, but I just couldn't see doing that for a career. So I went back to graduate school. I went to graduate school at the University of Texas, where I studied under Sheila Fitzpatrick, who doesn't do military history at all. And I really just focused on Soviet history because, of course, in the Army back in the 1980s, our prospective opponent there was the Soviet Union, and so everything we did was about countering the Soviet army. So that piqued my interest as well. So working with Sheila Fitzpatrick, I did a topic on the Soviet military. Not that she was really encouraging about that at all, but it worked out. Which ended up being my very first book, which is called Stalin's Reluctant Soldiers, published in 1996, I guess, by University Press of Kansas. And so from there, my graduate training was strictly in the Soviet era back then. We were studying in the 1980s. We kind of ended things with Stalin. So 1917 to 1953, that was the extent of Soviet history. But subsequent book projects compelled me to expand my vision forward. So, you know, after Stalin and into Cold War, into the war in Afghanistan. And all the while I'm doing that, well, as a faculty member here at Texas A&M, we have an Imperial Russia course, and the professor who was teaching that retired. And so I volunteered to teach it just because as I was studying Soviet history, there were all these hints about, well, this isn't all that unique. This is a holdover or some this continuity from the old regime to the new regime. And so as I prepared lectures and learned more about the Imperial Russia, about Imperial Russia, I became more interested in also expanding my vision about military back in time. And that's how I kind of ended up looking and learning about the Imperial Russian Army. And every now and then I'll come across things, concepts, information, personalities, and like, wow, I wish I had known this when I was writing about Soviet history. Mm-hmm. Definitely a continuity that affected the Soviet period that I would have done a better job explaining some things in the Soviet period if I'd known more about the Imperial period. So, that's kind of the big picture there in a nutshell.
Thank you. Since you bring up, going back into the Imperial there, that your book is basically focused on a period since the end of the Crimean War up to the Revolution there in 1917. So I was wondering what was the logic behind starting in 1856 there at the end of the reign of Nicholas I in the Crimean War? Given your topic, what makes that a logical point to start versus, at the beginning of Nicholas's reign or something like that?
Yeah, that's a really logical question. So there was just a huge break in Soviet history at that time. Russian history at that time, because the loss of the Crimean War and all the deficiencies that it revealed about Russia, economics and society in particular, gave Alexander II, the new Tsar, the opportunity to make drastic changes. Okay? And so those drastic changes, everything based out of the emancipation of the serfs, set up a new era. This is where the late imperial period really starts at that point. And it's very important for the military because actually that was one of the excuses that they gave for making the changes is to regain the military standing in Europe. But what was especially important because doing social history is from that point on, from the gearing up for emancipation and changing how the army was going to man the forces and the formerly serfs, now peasants, were now going to be citizens to one degree or another, completely changed the outlook of the soldiers. From Peter the Great up to 1855, or almost up to the emancipation, peasant soldiers expected to be treated pretty badly. They didn't want to be or look forward to that. That's how it was. Things weren't changing. They were at the bottom of the social order, powerless, and that's just how it was. But with the emancipation and peasants getting civil rights, property rights, freedom of movement, much greater access to education and social mobility, their expectations of how they would be treated in the military by the superiors was just a night and day difference from their fathers or grandfathers in the pre-reform army.
So you mentioned here that the peasants, former serfs' expectations changed quite a bit, but reading your book, the overall story here seems to be largely a continuity story about those expectations not being met, right?
Exactly.
Just thinking about the periodization you've given here, say, during the reign of the two Alexanders, Alexander II and Alexander III, what kinds of things don't change? What kinds of reforms you know, are attempted anyway? How do those reforms fail? Is that, could you riff on that for a bit?
Sure. The most important thing that didn't change was the attitude of the hereditary nobility overall, but specifically the officers. They still saw peasant soldiers as being socially at the bottom of the heap and with no rights as citizens. Not only did they see them as not having those rights, but not even deserving those rights. And so there's just an inherent clash. Now, that attitude, I kind of made it really seem very stark right there. It did begin to erode, after 50 years like that. So about after the turn of the century, and even here and there before that, you will find some, I would say, enlightened is probably the best descriptor there, officers who did have a really strong sense of humanitarianism, who did see the peasants as soldiers. But even all the way up to the collapse and after the collapse, the revolution or whatever, you still have these socially reactionary officers who just had no regard for the lower class of peasants and workers as human beings. And they just treated them so horribly. Of course, they could get away with that before emancipation. But afterwards, this just wasn't going to go uncontested. So that was a big missed opportunity. It genuinely was an opportunity because there were officers who said, we need to change with the times. We need to be better to these guys and treat them like human beings. And in fact, I think by 1912 is the last statistics they had, 52% of all the officers were not hereditary nobles, but had risen from either risen from the ranks or can't come from the peasantry or working class from civilian life. So that was a new generation that eventually would have become senior officers and could have changed that culture. But the culture was extremely resistant to change. And people who wanted to change, who tried to change, if they had a superior officer who was, reactionary and didn't want change to happen, he could stop that. He could punish officers, his subordinates, for being humane or soft, as they might want to call it. And so that just the regiment commander was all powerful. He was like a czar in his own right in that regiment and set the tone. If you had a humane, forward-thinking regiment commander, life was, I don't know if it would be good for soldiers, but certainly wouldn't be that very bad. But if you had a conservative or reactionary, socially elite regiment commander or higher, it was just going to be like there had been no emancipation.
Could you, for the uninitiated here, I'm guessing people might be interested in what is being treated poorly look like in practice? Like when you say that officers are, treating kind of extreme view of the soldiers as being inferior socially or culturally or whatever. What kinds of different forms does that take in practice?
Yeah, that's several different categories of how that played itself out. One was just in quality of life. So the regiment commanders were responsible for housing, feeding, clothing their soldiers. And if they were a good commander, they spent the allocated money on good quality uniforms, good quality food, proper bedding, accommodations. They didn't really have barracks for most of the troops until the turn of the century. It wasn't until under Alexander III in the 1880s that they started a massive barracks building program. So before that, the soldiers were quartered on the population for like 8 months of the year, living with peasants, and whatever quality of accommodations that might be. So But once they were in the barracks, then, you know, the officers had more control over heating, lighting, the cleanliness inside the barracks, the state of health in there. So, yeah, so maltreatment would be a bad officer would not spend all the money on the welfare of the soldiers. He'd mistreat them by cheating them, buying them inferior quality boots, inferior quality cloth for uniforms, inferior quality food or insufficient amounts of food, and pocket the difference. So, you know, corruption was endemic, but it was also very personally, you know, personally oriented. You have a good officer would not do that. A corrupt officer would. And there weren't a lot of institutional controls to prevent that. So there's that level of maltreatment. The other way is just actually interpersonal relations, where as a course of, I wouldn't really say discipline, because they had actually formal discipline where you had guard houses and extra duty and things like that. But just in ordinary interactions between officers and men, there was physical violence. They used the term, to teach was also synonymous with the word to beat. You know, go teach the soldiers a lesson. It also meant go beat them up. But any time a soldier, for whatever reason, irked a commander, he would just physically assault them, punch him in the mouth once, twice, three times, knock him to the ground, kick him. I mean, this is colonels and majors and captains, lieutenants would do this. And of course, the sergeants would as well. And the sergeants would get beaten by officers. It was just this interpersonal violence that was officially, after the emancipation, under the reforms, was officially, I can't say abolished, but it was officially proscribed. You're not supposed to do that. But it just wasn't very well regulated. It wasn't policed. And there were almost no consequences for actually continuing to engage in that behavior. Still, having said that, by the time World War I broke out, that level of interpersonal violence or mistreatment by soldiers, of soldiers by officers, had diminished considerably. And it kind of resurrected itself during the war. So it just had to kind of die out, or it didn't die out, it died down. But still, before the emancipation, when a soldier got smacked in the mouth and kicked and beaten, that wasn't that much different from being on a surface state, being abused by the bailiff, the steward, or the landlord, or his own father for whatever infractions. But those expectations had changed, that they expected to be treated like a free man with some kind of, you know, human dignity. So it didn't take that much to cause offense and resentment as the years go by.
Yeah, I mean, in general, when you look at kind of the broad narrative in the imperial era, of course, the Alexander II era, you know, has a reputation of being the liberalizing era, especially before, I guess, 1866, when that assassination attempt turned things around a bit. And then, of course, Alexander III, you know, has that reputation of being ultra-conservative, kind of reactionary and so on. So I was thinking about when you were sketching out, you know, the experience of soldiers going forward, like, does treatment of soldiers actually tend to get worse during the era of Alexander III, or are you still seeing, in spite of the overall political context, that things are gradually getting better, just perhaps not getting better faster enough?
Yeah, it's interesting. Alexander III, of all the czars in the 19th century, was probably the least interested in military affairs. He did stick his hands in there every now and then, and he certainly, of course, was on top of the promotions of senior officers, but I would say, to be direct, no, things did not get worse. that things did gradually improve, year by year, just by having more, well, I shouldn't say just, it's a really complex process, but having more and more non-nobles becoming officers, that certainly helped. But there was no green light to revisit, return to the old ways of being brutal on a kind of official basis. That stayed. The trend continued. Alexander is certainly known as being a reactionary. That was more political thing than actual with social relations.
Right, so that has an interesting effect of kind of nuancing our view of Alexander III a little bit. I was curious too. So far we've been talking about relations between the officers and the soldiers, kind of as though the officers are one thing, but as your book discusses in some detail, they're really not, right? There's all kinds of divisions. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the social divisions between the hereditary noble officers versus the ones that more come up through the ranks.
Yeah, that's actually quite a spider web of interconnectedness because even within each category of hereditary nobles and landed hereditary nobles and personal nobles and people coming up through the peasantry or from the urban educated class, all kinds of variations of outlook. Generally, even within the nobility, particularly no nobility who wouldn't go into the military, there was a high degree of liberalism, that more skepticism about the autocracy as a system. And of course, these people are related to their army officers and whatnot. So that actually did kind of creep in, that even among army officers at all different social levels, there was an increasing questioning of autocracy as being a viable political system for the long term. Of course, you're gonna have your ultra reactionaries who have no doubts that this is the way to go, but there was, and particularly it was exacerbated by Nicholas II, just because of him as the person being seen as weak and vacillating and indecisive, that a lot of officers turned against him and the system, whereas others just turned against him. So at all levels of social rank within the military, you're going to have more liberal attitudes, okay? Which is going to take a long time for them to become dominant, but they are there. And of course, they're at the lower levels, lieutenants, captains, whatever. It takes decades for those people to become generals and have a real impact. But so you have your general trend, and I'm being kind of loose with this, of liberalism, but you also have your reactionaries, but you also have your radicals. If you studied the revolutionary movements in Russia at the late imperial period, a great many of the radical terrorists or the Marxists or the socialist revolutionaries came out of the nobility. So they have that wing that's rejecting autocracy completely, wanting to destroy it and go into some kind of a socialist government, political and social system. And those people found their way into the military as well. So you actually had members of People's Will terrorist organization in the army, and they were all nobles. So those are the extremes, ultra-reactionary to literally bomb-throwing revolutionaries. In uniform from the wealthiest families coexisting, of course, until they're found out. And the soldiers coming in from the below, the non-nobles who are coming in, was a real mixed bag. You have a very large number saw commissioning in the army as a sort of a fast track to social mobility. You actually leave the peasantry behind or the working class behind and become a commissioned officer, which automatically made a person a personal noble. meaning their nobility wasn't passed down through their family, but they actually had noble privileges in Russian society. And they can become a hereditary noble if they reach the rank of colonel. So in that sense, this is a real mixed bag. It's like they're joining for personal social mobility. They're making more money. They can marry into a higher category of family they want. And of course, and to be an officer, you have to above average education. Of course, the average education in Russia was extremely low at the time. But you had the above average education, which also opens the doors if you don't want to stay in the military. And the question is, well, were they then attaching their values to autocracy? Because autocracy runs the army and establishes a social system. Or were they really self-serving and like, well, I'll serve in the military now, maybe make a career of it, elevate myself and my family, but I don't really share in all the values of autocracy. Might love the military, love that type of service, whatever, but still harbor doubts and be ready to work against the autocracy down the road. So we have all of that. And definitely there comes the person of the czar. So people did not, when they commissioned, they didn't swear loyalty to Russia or a constitution or some kind of abstract concept of the nation. They swore loyalty directly to the czar. And how did the people feel about that? Well, at the upper levels and the wealthiest of the nobility, generals, people who make it to general have the access to the higher cadet corps and the paid corps pages for education. They really took that seriously. It's like they served the czar and they saw him as their benefactor, but also he was the locus of their military identity. But people coming from the lower classes really seem not to have had that kind of a personal attachment to the person of the czar, the idea of the czar, but more of the idea of the nation and the more abstract ideas of citizenship and nationhood. So, and they wouldn't probably ever be around the czar ever in their whole military career. Whereas a senior officer who got assigned to the Guards regiments, served in St. Petersburg, well, they would have been around the czar physically a lot. And so there's a personal physical connection there that the majority of the army, the lower rankers of the officer corps who come from the peasantry or lower classes would never have. So that's also a rift there in the officer corps. People who identified personally with the czar and people who maybe had an abstract and a more skeptical view of the czar coming up. So there was a real change going, underway. But cultural change takes, quite a long time. Like, turning a battleship, that doesn't happen on a dime. So, and so again, with the, I think the point you were trying to get me to, and I might be getting there now. The lower ranking officers, the new generation coming in through the Junker schools, who have achieved that on merit in the 1880s, 1890s, they do have a different view of the political system, their place in it, their place in the army, that they also understood was different from their superiors.
I think maybe this might be a good time to bring up a couple of pretty important concepts you discuss in here. I personally thought this was one of my favorite parts of the book, was where you're making that distinction between the army of honor and the army of virtue. And I thought it might be useful to people to hear you talk about what do those terms mean, and what's the significance of the transition from one to the other?
Oh, yeah, that's a... I don't know if you wanted to get into that or not, but I really like talking about that sort of thing. So from, I don't know, the Middle Ages or when, maybe that might be going too far back, but under monarchical systems, the king, the queen, emperor, empress, even and the princes and other principalities, they were the commander-in-chief. They were the head of state, and the army belonged to them. It didn't belong to the government. It belonged to the people. It was their army, and they decided who got to lead it and serve them personally, that the monarchs chose people for their loyalty, mostly. Capacity kind of came second, and people were in an army of honor. It was an honor to serve you, and how much honor you had was kind of a determined by the monarch. And so how faithful you were to the monarch had a lot to do with how high you rose within the military hierarchy. So it was, military service was really about pleasing the monarch. So not about military proficiency, not about success in combat. Those things helped and were necessary, but as long as you had an in with the monarch or the royal family, had a patron, that actually covered a lot more ground or promotion than military competence. So then that was universal around Europe, armies of honor, okay? And typically only open to the nobility, with exceptions here and there. So being an officer was a noble pursuit, and you served the king, served at the pleasure of the king, and you got promoted at the pleasure of the king or queen, the monarch. So this begins to change, obviously, with the French Revolution, opening up of society, rise of the middle class, industrialization and urbanization, and the technological advancements in military, and the growth of the military. So the size of armies. So typically now across Europe in the early to mid 19th century, the nobility couldn't provide that many officers, and they typically weren't that educated in order to handle the new technologies, because you didn't need an education to be an officer. You just needed to have the right social qualifications. So they gradually began, because of all these various factors, they being the armies of Europe, began opening up the officer corps to the middle class, or non-nobles in general, you could say, people with higher educations or sufficient educations who wanted to serve. And so they start to come in fairly significant numbers. And they don't have connections to the monarch or the social pedigrees that would get them promoted rapidly to higher responsibilities. And this bothered them, right? It's like, I merit promotion by what I've done for this army, how I've performed in peacetime and in wartime. And to see officers who didn't merit promotion but had the social pedigrees and connections get promoted really bothered them. So the idea of being promoted on merit is the concept the foundation of an army of virtue. So you have this transition all across Europe of this, the people who deserve to be promoted on merit competing with people who are promoted on basis of honor, on social status, social relationship. And by and large, other than the Russian army, Europe had kind of made that transition by the time World War I has broken out. There are still aspects of armies of honor, like so Russia had the Guards Corps. So all those Guards units were exclusively noble officers with connections to St. Petersburg, to the capital, to the Tsar, the royal family. But that was a small slice of the army, like 22 regiments with hundreds of non-guard regiments out there. So it had two armies coexisting, the Army of Merit out there, then the Army of Honor in St. Petersburg. But and in Germany or Prussia, he had guards units that were intimately related to Wilhelm II. But other than that, the French, even Austro-Hungarian army, British army, they were armies of virtue, that you did have to perform well to succeed and social connections would take you only so far, that it took merit to go farther. So this was a problem in the Imperial Army because they hadn't crossed that threshold yet, but they were approaching it. And the expectations of the younger generations of non-nobles were very high, that they should have a fairer shot at the regimental commands, at promotions to general, than they were actually getting. And so that's going to, another dividing point within the Russian officer corps.
So where all this is headed, really, in the long run, I think, is what's the role of the breakdown of discipline in the army? What does that contribute to the collapse of the monarchy and the Bolshevik takeover and so on? So maybe what we ought to talk about next then is, is there a tipping point you can point to where, relations between officers and soldiers are improving, but perhaps not enough to save discipline in the army during the First World War? It seemed to me like between events in the capital and then events in Siberia and the Russo-Japanese War, it seemed to me like 1905 served as kind of a tipping point in the book. But I thought maybe you could elaborate on that, or maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Does that seem about right to you?
Yeah, I think you read my book correctly. You you understand what I'm getting at. There's a revolution of 1905. It lasted until 1907. Amongst the civilians in all parts of Russia, from disgruntled peasants seizing the land to radical revolutionaries in the cities and workers wanting their rights respected and better working conditions. They started it, but the soldiers join in late 1905 and then continue through 1906, 1907. And their basic, so actually that's a low point, that as society is revolting around them, the soldiers decide, well, that's, they're saying the same things that we feel, that we're not being treated respectfully. We don't have the opportunities for advancement that we want. And it's a conscript army. We need to kind of remind our audience of that. So they join in, and really across the board, their demands, when they mutiny, and the very few of them were actually violent mutinies, but there definitely were some. But their mutinies were refusal to obey orders, refusal to go to work, And their demands were improve their quality of life. They wanted sheets on their bunks in the barracks. I mean, they hadn't had sheets. They didn't have blankets. They had to wrap up in their overcoats. They wanted pillows. They wanted to get the food in the quantity and quality that they were ordered to get, that they were being denied. And they wanted to not get beaten up so much. And even then, in 1905, 1906, when they're making these demands, the level of physical violence is probably at its lowest in 200 years. But they're still like, it shouldn't happen at all. They agreed to corporal punishment for an actual crime, but just to get smacked around because you weren't quick enough to salute or stand at attention or whatever it was, that it was just intolerable to that generation. And they wanted shorter terms of service. It was 6 years, so they wanted to get that down to three. And they actually got that. So with the revolution of 1905 resulted in a constitution for Russia, the apparent end of autocracy, a creating of a parliamentary monarchy, and the terms of conscription were reduced to 3 years. The officers were told, we are going to now issue sheets and blankets and pillows, and we'll make sure the soldiers get the food that they're entitled to. And they weren't asking for more. They're just like, give us what we're entitled to. And so there was a real concerted, honest effort to do that. And so you can see the relations actually improved at that point. You say it took a while to get this implemented, but from 1908, probably, is a good point. 1908, 1914, things were on the rise. Relationships were improving. Treatment was improving. The quality of life was improving inside the military, not just for soldiers, but even for the lower ranking officers. You know, they were feeling that we've kind of turned a corner here. Maybe we're going to get that army of virtue that we've been hoping for under a new constitutional system rather than with the czar, you know, exercising all this patronage. Although that actually was a false hope because the czar remained commander in chief. Okay. So, well, then at this point you say, well, there shouldn't have been a revolution. The army should have remained loyal. But the problem was the war kind of undid all of that. In fact, one of the first things the Tsar did was to get the Duma to agree to go out of session and kind of suspend the Constitution, which in effect restored autocracy, which emboldened the more reactionary of the officers and who had resented all this, you know, catering to the soldiers' desires. And they didn't really acknowledge that these were real needs. They were just what the soldiers wanted, you know. Kind of in denial that they had been treated poorly beforehand. So, you know, with the war, the progress not only stops, but it begins to get worse again. And it's really a direct result of the war, that the officer corps has to expand dramatically with short-term training of new officers who are, the qualifications are dropped, and less educated, less imbued with the military ethos that's supposed to govern behavior, and the massive casualties among officers. So you get a kind of a deprofessionalized officer corps in 1915, 1916. And then of course, the quality of life declines. I mean, life in the trenches is obviously not good. The quality of food declines, not by design, but the whole country was having a food crisis. Logistical crisis and delivering the things soldiers needed, but also it's kind of inexplicable the return of the physical brutality between officers and men. And this was mostly on those more, you know, it's a personal thing, the reactionary type officers. And I'm just kind of thinking of this right now, but you know, it might have been just kind of anger that the soldiers had forced this amelioration of their conditions by the revolution. And it was like, well, we'll see how that goes. We're going to turn the clock back just to show you that we as nobles are still in charge. But even so, you don't really see that so much among educated middle-class men who become officers. But surprisingly, you do see it among a lot of the peasants who become these wartime officers, who are pretty much uncultured and used to the more physical confrontational style within the peasant villages, who bring that to the army, and there's no one really to put that in check. It's the war, the casualties, the demoralization of the idea that they're not going to win this war, the idea of the futility of it. And it's just it's compounded by the fact that, yeah, the Tsarist government never really sold the war to the people. That it was not like the Great Patriotic War in World War II, where people were invested in that victory. They just really weren't in World War I. They didn't really see the sense of it. And so all the losses were senseless. The suffering was senseless.
I'm thinking about what how you're characterizing relations between officers and the rank and file during the First World War there, and trying to imagine then where that description fits in terms of the overall set of arguments about the reasons the autocracy collapsed and the reasons the Bolsheviks triumphed and so on. I don't know, occurs to me that in some ways, your explanation kind of puts important individuals back into the equation. Like it kind of puts Nicholas II back into the story of how the revolution happened. But at the same time, it looks like there's some kind of big structural factors that your explanation points us to. I don't know, so would you say that your research in the book kind of points to a mix of individual and structural factors that create the autocracy's collapse?
Definitely, there's quite a mix. And the personal is the czar himself, where his reputation, not just within the military, but within Russian society, it was just in tatters during the war for a variety of reasons that come to, that I'll get into those in just a second, but there comes a moment where the army has to decide, are we going to keep this guy in power or not? You know, and they decide not to because of who he is and how he is perceived. He has been perceived for a long time as being weak. According to him, also, you know, preface this by to the bitter end, he did have some supporters, but their numbers are dwindling, by the minute. As things go on, but he was perceived as weak, vacillating, and interfering. You know, he went to the front to take charge of the army in 1915 after the major disaster of the German Austro-Hungarian summer offensive. And he didn't actually really take complete charge, but he was there, and people saw him as being in the way and ineffectual. The high command did, but he also had we all know his wife was German, and so. The rumors got started, and it just people believed them. It was basically fake news, but that she was a German spy. The Russian people across the board, and civilians and soldiers, and even some officers, believed that. It's like, well, yeah, we can't win as long as the Tsar's wife is selling secrets or giving secrets away to the Germans. You know, she it's kind of a reflection of a lot of. Russian xenophobia from that time. So, and they're talking about this in the trenches. It's like, you know, no point in attacking. We're going to lose. We're all going to die because the Tsarina is you know, selling us out. And the Tsar won't do anything about it. And there were actually very senior officers and even family members told him, you need to somehow like send her off somewhere out of the capital, out of the public eye. So for your own good, he wouldn't do that. Then there's the Rasputin thing, you know, the idea that Rasputin, the monk, he's the one who could keep the Tsarevich, the heir to the throne, alive by stopping his bleeding because he was the hemophiliac through hypnosis or whatever, or prayer and all this stuff. The rumors were that, well, on the one hand, they're not actually the truth. Rasputin was sleeping with everybody and every woman in Petersburg he could possibly get into bed, but not the Tsarina. Right? He was smarter than that. He kept his complete appropriate behavior around her. But the rumors were that, of course, he was. You know, they were living this had this debauched relationship, and that was a disgrace to the Tsar, disgrace to the Russia. And again, people are saying you need to get rid of Rasputin, get him out of there. You know, get it. But people believe that. They really believe that. That the Tsarina was living a dissolute, disreputable life that discredited the whole monarchy. And of course, being a spy doesn't help anything like that. And so people like, again, Nicholas, why aren't you doing anything? You're weak. You're not taking charge of your wife there like you know, Russian men are supposed to. So that is a huge stain that just worked against him in everybody's eyes. So when the soldiers revolt. And this is one of the interesting things. The soldiers who suffered the most, the guys at the front lines, taking the casualties and living in the trenches and with the frostbite and the bad food, they were not the ones to start the revolt. It was trainees in the capital who, these are young guys, we're talking 19-year-olds who hadn't been to the front, who joined in with the revolution. Workers actually started the revolution. I'll make sure I don't get ahead of myself there. But for the army, the soldiers of the garrison, who were actually trainees in basic training, getting ready to go to the front as replacements, they joined in the revolution and supported it for a variety of reasons, one of which they didn't want to go to the front. They'd heard all the stories about what it was like up there, and they didn't want to go. So they're the ones who kind of gave the muscle to the revolution in the capital, and then came up with the infamous Order Number One, which, Order Number One of the Petrograd Soviet, the alternative government to the provisional government that emerged eventually. That one of the major demands that they wrote on their things was like, we will never be sent to the front. It was very self-serving, about protecting themselves from the war, but also protecting themselves from the officers. Like, don't give up your weapons. You don't have to salute off duty. You can do all these other things that ordinary soldiers around the world were able to do by this time. But once that word got to the front that the people, the soldiers in Petrograd were doing that, the soldiers at the front, like, that's a great idea. We should protect ourselves from our officers and form committees to decide what orders to obey. And basically the purpose of those committees was to keep from being sent on senseless attacks, incurring more casualties. I mean, that is the ultimate bottom line, is they wanted to have these soldiers' committees that would vote on whether they're going to obey orders or not. But that was really about, we're not going to attack and sacrifice our lives for nothing anymore. So the soldiers up the front join in opposition to the Tsar and the government, but they don't start it. But at the time, it's actually the senior officers who play at the high command at the front, who play the critical role, that they take advantage of the revolution in the capital to force the abdication.
That last point you made was I thought perhaps one of the most striking points in the book, was how the senior officers really kind of, what's the metaphor I need here, pulled the rug out from under their own feet. I hope I didn't just mix my metaphors by doing that. So could you, kind of clarify how that was, how their rejection of the Tsar is legitimate, ultimately contributed to their own dissolution as a class?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's so ironic. With the turmoil in the capital, and the soldiers and the workers marched onto the Duma, which was not actually in session, the old parliament. They declared the Duma to be the new government. It's just mob action, and so the parliamentary members there decided, yes, this is a great opportunity to end autocracy, get a real constitution, and get Russia on the road to liberalism and victory in the war. So they contacted the high command and said, this is what's up. We can use this opportunity to get a responsible government, write a new constitution, keep the monarchy, but not autocracy, but change the rules and make the monarchy more of a figurehead, kind of like Britain is today. So that was the proposal that the high command got, the generals at the front. And they looked at it and they're like, they wanted to keep the monarchy. They were fine with that. Some of them that they thought the proposal to have a responsible government and a new constitution, that was the way to go. Others, not so sure. But they all agreed, all the generals agreed. They actually sent a telegram out to all the army commanders, corps commanders, like, what do you think? Do we use this opportunity to get rid of Nicholas? They wanted to get rid of that guy, not necessarily the monarchy. Well, they did not want to get rid of the monarchy, flat out. Want to keep the monarchy, just get rid of Nicholas. That was their goal. So they actually kind of preempted the civilians who were willing to keep Nicholas and the monarchy, but under new terms. And so they forced him to abdicate. And they were hoping, but their intent was for him to abdicate to his son, Alexei, the hemophiliac, knowing that he was too young to take the throne, so there'd be a regent, someone would rule in his stead until he grew up, and they would hopefully have a say in who that would be, somebody obviously in the royal family. But Nicholas instead abdicated to his younger brother, Michael. But Michael didn't, Michael kind of got caught like blindsided by that. He did not expect to be asked to be the czar that day. But as soon as the revolutionaries in the capital found out about the abdication, they said they would kill anybody who tried to assume the throne. And Michael decided that that was a real threat and declined to take the throne unless there was popular support for him to take it, knowing that that wasn't going to happen. And so now there's nobody on the throne. The monarchy is vacant and declared dissolved by the mob, by the radicals. And the civilian government in Petrograd and our officers at the front, the high command at the front, all of a sudden found themselves in a situation they had not intended to create. The end of the monarchy, which had, the monarchy is what legitimized an army of honor. You don't need a guards corps if you don't have a czar to guard. You don't know social mobility through connections anymore. So those guys were absolutely devastated by that. It was like an instant transition to army of virtue, which some people wanted that, and others didn't. But during the middle of a war, that was kind of a drastic outcome that they did not intend.
And so I suppose, as the Brits say, that looks kind of like a pretty spectacular own goal on the part of the senior officers. So would it be accurate to say then that they just didn't envision that the reaction that the urban radicals would have to that abdication, and that's why they didn't see that coming?
I think you're exactly right, that they didn't really appreciate the depth and breadth of the revolution in the capital and the power of it, and it was spreading across Russia. They completely underestimated, which was kind of typical of the senior elites, their social classes to just underestimate the lower classes. They did not understand that they were dealing with a new animal. It took them a few weeks to figure out that the Petrograd Soviet was a real political force that could mobilize people to get done what they wanted to get done.
So I guess we're about out of time here. So maybe a good way of wrapping up might be to observe the following, that it looks to me like the overall thrust of your book here is that there were plenty of opportunities for the military to reform itself so that when the pressures of the First World War came around, that the army could have survived, its internal discipline could have survived and so on. But then for all the reasons that you've been sketching out, that didn't happen. Does that seem an accurate summation here?
Yes, I would never say that the mutiny and the revolution of the soldiers was inevitable. There were people who saw the way to change, who worked for that change, and they just didn't have the backing and the time to make that change happen.
And so in a lot of ways, that becomes another one of history's great what ifs, I think, that it's full of.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because there were other reforms going on in civil society that were trying to, make things better for everybody. And the Stolypin reforms were one of them. And he told Nicholas to his face, we need 20 years of peace. Like after the revolution of 1905, give me 20 years of peace and we'll get stability. And he got 8 years of peace.
And so in some ways, I suppose all of the subject matter you're covering in your book, perhaps lends some credence to Stolypin's view there, that perhaps the reforms inside the military that you sketched out as evolving slowly over time, maybe that would have given them enough time to really emerge with, a new kind of officer dominating the scene.
Right. It would have taken the whole new generation to make that happen. That's what, I guess 20 years is a generation. That's what Stolypin was saying. Give me a generation.
Right.
Change. And and we'll get the stability and the national commitment to success that we need down the road.
Huh. Well, and as they say, the rest is history, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us, Roger. This is quite an interesting book, not something I've done a lot of reading on myself, so I was glad to expand my horizons a little bit. So thank you.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, bye now.
Bye-bye.